Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, North Korea takes action after approval of UN sanctions against it. Experts consider if debris found may be from the ill-fated Malaysian Airlines flight MH370. The WHO says childhood hearing loss can be prevented. And small SUVs are all the rage at the Geneva Auto Show.
Every stand here at the Geneva Motor Show will have crossovers, SUVs. This is a segment which continues to grow.
It's right here on the Voice of America. North Korea fired several short-range projectiles off its eastern coast today, hours after the UN Security Council unanimously approved a new resolution that U.S. UN Ambassador Samantha Power described as the strongest sanctions imposed in more than two decades, in a bid to halt the North's prescribed missile and nuclear programs.
This resolution represents a seismic shift in the way the Council approaches DPRK proliferation concerns. It recognizes at its core that in order to prevent the DPRK from continuing to advance its nuclear weapons program, the international community has to be prepared to sanction sectors beyond those directly related to the nuclear weapons program or their ballistic missile program. Let me be clear, though, the true measure of Resolution 2270 will be whether the rigor with which states implement these sanctions matches the rigor we can anticipate the DPRK will apply to attempting to evade them. While this resolution adopted today is robust, comprehensive, and unyielding, to be effective, it must be followed with robust, comprehensive, and unyielding enforcement.
Cargo inspections, mineral export bans, an arms embargo, bans on fuel and luxury goods, tightened banking sanctions, and the blacklisting of entities and individuals should, according to President Obama, send Pyongyang a simple message. Abandon these dangerous programs and choose a better path for the North Korean people. RAND Corporation Korea expert Bruce Bennett says questions remain over just how effective the new sanctions will be and how strictly they will be enforced.
Most of the sanctions have some element of exception associated with them. So coal can be sold if it impacts the livelihood of the coal miners. Well, okay, so North Korea doesn't sell its coal. The coal miners aren't going to get paid, so it does affect their livelihood. Will that actually be practiced, or will it be enforced as originally intended? And many of these things are uncertain, especially the enforcement mechanisms. How will we know when it's being violated, and what will our countries be willing to do if it is violated?
Council diplomats quoted by Reuters say these sanctions are even tougher than the ones imposed on Iran over its nuclear program.
Yes, but there it was pretty clear that everybody was on board to enforcing the sanctions. It's less clear that Russia, given the exceptions it introduced, and that China are as much on board. We're just going to have to see by their behavior.
The U.S. UN ambassador noted these sanctions are hugely significant, but also acknowledges that the North Koreans are masters of evasion.
Exactly, and that's the real issue. I mean, these sanctions, they are much, much tougher. But the key issue is, will they get imposed or will they not? We'll see over the coming weeks.
We asked if he was confident these sanctions would do something to affect North Korea's nuclear and missile programs.
Yeah, I think they will do at least something. The question is, these sanctions probably in and of themselves, even if well enforced, probably aren't enough to force North Korea to stop those programs. North Korea is very determined on them, but they may be enough to significantly cripple those programs if adequately enforced.
Meanwhile, China's ambassador has expressed concern about the possibility that a U.S. anti-missile system would be deployed to South Korea, and he talked about a return to a six-party dialogue.
Well, I think if China had acted like a great power in the first place, North Korea would have never been allowed to develop the Nodong or the Musudong missiles that pose the threat that the THAAD missile system, defense system, is designed to deal with. Now China needs to decide to act like a great power and get those weapons removed from North Korea.
And the RAND Corporation's Bruce Bennett says, as for the six-party talks, the North wants to return to those talks to be declared a nuclear power, not to denuclearize. And under that circumstance, the U.S. will not return to the talks. He also says the sanctions could have a destabilizing effect on the North. Now, Andrew Palchevsky has a look at social media trends.
A big story we're seeing trending today actually started yesterday, and that's the earthquake in Indonesia, 7.8 magnitude earthquake that struck that country. And immediately after this happened, we were already seeing hashtag Indonesia, hashtag pray for Indonesia pop up on social media. And we also saw social media being used as a way to connect the people of Indonesia with the world, not just with this tragedy and connecting them and lending support, but for those people of Indonesia to communicate that they were all right, people tweeting out saying, I'm okay, my family's okay. So it's a valuable communication tool when other lines of communication are severed. Another way social media is likely to be used in the coming days is for people to lend their monetary support or send supplies. A lot of people might be using social media to organize these campaigns to send supplies to Indonesia to actually physically support that country. So we'll see those campaigns, I'm sure, popping up in the coming days. Another story now out of Europe, where Facebook is facing an antitrust investigation. A court in Europe has said they're investigating the social media behemoth, alleging that they've been unfair and not competing properly in Europe, and that they've been misusing their role as the social media behemoth that they are to collect people's data and not disclosing that. Now, other companies, social media companies, tech companies, have faced similar investigations, Microsoft, Google, for example. It'll be interesting to see how Facebook responds to this. I'm venturing to guess that being the multi-billion dollar company that they are and such a big social media company, that they'll have some very good lawyers working on this case. But what it ultimately means is that there may be some changes to Facebook's privacy. They may have to disclose some things. But surely this is going to be a process that takes weeks, if not months, if not years, to play out through the legal system. But it certainly will be a headache for Facebook.
Thanks, Andrew. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
U.S. astronauts Scott Kelly and Russian cosmonaut Mikhail Kornienko have safely returned to Earth after the two men spent a record 340 days in space at the International Space Station. Joining the duo for the ride home aboard a Soyuz TMA-18M spacecraft was Russian cosmonaut Sergei Volkov. The three touched down at 4:26 UTC on Thursday, March 2nd, in a remote town in Kazakhstan. Shortly after landing, Expedition 46 Commander Kelly remarked,
"It was, leaving the space station was bittersweet. You know, I've been there a long time, so I look forward to leaving. But at the same time, you know, it's a magnificent place, and I'm going to miss it. So, mixed emotions, I guess."
NASA Administrator Charles Bolden said Scott Kelly's 1 year in space has helped advance deep space exploration and America's journey to Mars. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
What is described as the leading edge of the right-hand tail section of an aircraft was discovered this week on the shore of Mozambique in southeastern Africa. The Malaysian transport minister said there is a high probability it could be from a Boeing 777, the same type of aircraft as the ill-fated Malaysian Airlines flight MH370, which disappeared after takeoff March 8, 2014 from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing, with 239 passengers and crew aboard, mostly Chinese. The debris, measuring about 1 meter, is to be transported to Australia for further investigation by Malaysian, Australian, and Boeing aircraft officials. It follows the discovery of a wing fragment called a flapperon on the shores of the Indian Ocean island of Reunion last July. Australian Transport Minister Darren Chester said today it is too early to link the debris to the missing Malaysian jetliner.
The Australian Transport Safety Bureau is undertaking that work on behalf of the three countries involved in the search, obviously Australia, Malaysia and China. but it is way too early, and I wouldn't want to fuel any undue speculation. It's way too early to tell where the piece of metal has come from. What we do is we get the piece of metal back to Australia. We'll have Boeing engineers look at it in conjunction with Australian investigators. Our role, obviously, as a lead agency in Australia, is to continue the search area in the Southern Ocean, but when there's a piece of metal found of interest to us, they'll be properly assessed. And now, you know, out of respect to the families involved, I wouldn't want to fuel any undue speculation in relation to the origin of the piece of metal.
Families of the victims of Flight 370 issued an appeal today on the website Voice 370, urging authorities to keep the nearly two-year search for the missing aircraft going. That search, led by Australia, is centered on a deep-sea zone in the southern Indian Ocean and is scheduled to be ended by mid-year. James Chin, a Malaysian analyst at the University of Tasmania in Australia, tells VOA's Victor Beattie Malaysians are confident this is part of MH370.
Because last year there was another piece found on Reunion Island, which is located in the same region. So many people in Malaysia are quite optimistic that after the investigation is done on this piece, it will probably end up as another one of the missing pieces for the MH370.
The Australian Transport Chief said Thursday the location of the debris found on the beach is consistent with what he called drift modeling related to the search for the missing aircraft.
That was exactly what was said when the earlier piece was found in Reunion Island. Reunion Island and Mozambique is located in eastern Africa, so they're roughly in the same region.
We're coming up now on the second anniversary of the aircraft going missing.
The latest on this aircraft is that several family members have started litigation against Malaysian Airlines in Australia and Malaysia to declare all the passengers dead and also to get some compensation from Malaysian Airlines.
There are now new efforts afoot to make sure that aircraft like this are better tracked by ground controllers.
Yes, there was a meeting 2 years ago, and the Malaysian government put a proposal to the International Aviation Association that all aircraft flying international route must have what is known as live reporting. In other words, they will be kept tracked by radar in real time. That proposal was accepted, but I believe there are some implementation issues, especially in some parts of the world where there will be huge financial commitments.
Well, there's still theories swirling around the disappearance of this aircraft, one of the greatest mysteries in aviation history. What are the best theories that have some weight to them?
Well, I think the conspiracy theory has died down. The only place where the conspiracy theory is still widely held will probably be in China. Many of the families of the Chinese passengers still believe that some foul play was involved and somehow the Malaysian government or the Malaysian pilot was involved in the disappearance of the aircraft.
Well, what's the general consensus as far as a hijacking, a rogue action by the pilot or a mechanical problem?
No. Among the experts appear to be split. Some of the experts believe that it was a mechanical failure, while another lot of experts believe that this was a deliberate attempt by the pilot.
James Chin says he believes media and political pressure will prod investigators to complete their assessment sooner rather than later. He expects a determination on the new debris to be made within the next 10 days. Coming up on International Edition, a new report on hearing and a look at what's hot at the Geneva Auto Show. New York City reaches another milestone in the effort to rebuild after the September 11, 2001 terror attacks, with today's opening of a $4 billion transportation hub. Spanish architect Santiago Calatrava designed the facility with its striking white steel ribs and glass rising out of the ground next to where the Twin Towers once stood. It combines retail shops with a massive commuter rail station that includes links to 11 subway lines. People will only gain access to part of the site with today's opening. The rest is expected to become fully operational in a few months. And the retail portion is due to open later this year with more than 60 stores and restaurants. A new report by the World Health Organization finds up to 60% of childhood hearing loss can be prevented. To mark this year's World Hearing Day today, The UN agency is campaigning to raise awareness of the importance of early detection and intervention in preventing or mitigating the loss of this sense in children. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization reports 360 million people around the globe suffer from disabling hearing loss and that nearly 32 million are children. Among that number, 31 million live in middle and low-income countries. Alaco Cieza coordinates WHO's program on blindness and deafness prevention. She says an estimated 40% of childhood hearing loss can be attributed to genetics, with another 31% linked to infections.
We know that there are infections from childhood illness like mumps, meningitis, measles, or common, very common ear infections, or infections of the mother like rubella. So the action here would be simply immunization, or when it is common hearing loss, then the action is good hearing care.
Cieza says nearly one-fifth of hearing loss cases in childhood is due to complications at birth, low birth weight, and neonatal jaundice. She says maternal and child health programs can prevent this from happening. She tells VOA the stigma associated with hearing loss often discourages families from seeking help for their children. She says community-based rehabilitation programs can create awareness and counter the stigma.
WHO is the UN agency behind this community development strategy, and one of the focus is to combat stigma and empower people with disabilities and their families.
Cieza says this strategy is being implemented in more than 100 middle and low-income countries. She says early identification of children with hearing loss is crucial in triggering the needed interventions, such as providing hearing devices. Where this is not possible, she says giving deaf children the ability to communicate through sign language and other educational skills can dramatically improve their lives. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
There's something new on the beaches of Australia, or actually nearby in the water. It's a so-called clever buoy that uses technology to scan the surf for sharks and then warn people in real time via mobile app. Craig Anderson with Shark Mitigation Systems explains how the buoy works.
So it uses a multi-beam sonar, which is relatively new sonar technology, coupled with some software that we've co-written.
If the buoy detects anything swimming underwater larger than 2 meters in length, it automatically sends out a warning to the app, alerting anyone in the area. That gives lifeguards a heads up about a possible shark so they can keep the beaches safe. And with time, we may see more clever buoys popping up off Australia's other beaches. For What's New, I'm Doug Bernard.
Lovers worldwide have their eyes on Switzerland this month, where the Geneva Auto Show features innovations in automotive design and technology. International Edition's David Byrd reports that small SUVs are all the rage, as are concept cars that include self-driving technology.
A generation ago, many families had station wagons. Now, the sport utility vehicle has taken over as the way to haul both people and things. But SUVs had one drawback. They were thirsty. With more fuel efficiency mandated on the European continent, automakers had to come up with a solution fast. The car makers have brought several more fuel-efficient models alongside electric and hybrid cars to the Geneva Auto Show. Tim Pollard is the editor-in-chief of Car Magazine.
Every stand here at the Geneva Motor Show will have crossovers, SUVs. This is a segment which continues to grow. By 2020, car makers tell me it's going to account for at least a quarter of the European car market. So we're flabbergasted. You know, the continual shift away from MPVs, people carriers and the like. SUVs show no sign of slowing down anytime soon.
Europe's car industry has been struggling since the Eurozone crisis over bank debt started in 2009. But it did emerge from the slow market last year, and SUVs are leading the way.
Tim Urquhart is an analyst at IHS Automotive.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very profitable business, largely because the car makers can base these crossovers and SUVs on conventional car underpinnings, platforms and powertrains and use the same technology. So you get two models for the price of one, basically. It's the way customer trends are going. It's the way the market is going. And they're able to also integrate very efficient powertrains into these cars. So just because they're notionally crossovers and SUVs doesn't mean they're gas guzzlers as well.
But it's not just SUVs that are catching attention. Self-driving vehicles are also on the horizon. In Geneva, Nissan showcased its driverless IDS concept car with a retractable steering wheel. Nissan Europe chairman Paul Wilcox says that drivers can look for an autonomous piloted highway model next year.
In 2017, we'll be announcing the first ladder up of autonomous drive features on Qashqai. So we're announcing we'll have autonomous highway piloted autonomous features on Qashqai from next year. So we have the first step in place in Europe from 2017.
And if high performance is your taste, then Bugatti rolled out just what you're looking for, a 2.4 million euro Chiron. The supercar features a W16 8-liter engine, which blasts out 1,500 horsepower and has a maximum speed of 420 kilometers per hour. Or maybe the Lamborghini Centenario is more your speed. The sleek, windswept supercar marks 100 years since the birth of Lamborghini founder Ferruccio Lamborghini. It has a 770-horsepower engine, and its shell is made entirely of carbon fiber. But it is a look-don't-touch car at Geneva. Only 40 of the Lambos were made this year, and they have all sold for around 2 million euros each. The Geneva Auto Show runs until March 13th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and India face a common challenge, overcoming the threat of terrorism. The rise of groups like ISIL underscores the limits of conventional approaches. We need a broader, bolder, and smarter approach to turn back terrorism, said Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell. One that goes beyond countering terrorists with our military, intelligence, and law enforcement tools to also preventing people from becoming terrorists in the first place. The best way to do that is through a comprehensive approach that calls for partnerships at every level between government and civil society. Public officials play a role by governing effectively and upholding the rule of law. At the same time, religious, business, and academic leaders need to challenge violent extremism and promote messages of peace. Religious leaders are among the most critical actors in pushing back against violent extremism, said Undersecretary Sewell. They can teach curious young minds tenets of faith and refute extremist interpretations that exalt violence. Across India, from Kerala to Kashmir, faith communities are mobilizing to challenge violent extremism. 1.5 million Muslims from the region gathered in Uttar Pradesh last month to reject global terrorism and affirm the Quran's injunction that killing one innocent person is equivalent to killing all humanity. More than 70,000 clerics from around the world gathered in Bareilly to condemn ISIL as inhuman and un-Islamic. And in Delhi, students at a local college lit candles to outshine ISIL's darkness as Muslim women raised their voices to decry ISIL for carrying out such inhuman acts in the name of Allah. Governments can help by ending stifling regulations on civil society and allowing citizen groups to peacefully speak and organize around sensitive topics. They can go a step further by proactively reaching out to build ties with communities targeted by violent extremists for recruitment, like in Maharashtra, where local police are partnering with local clerics to de-radicalize youth. As detailed in the U.S.-India Joint Declaration on Combating Terrorism, the U.S. stands shoulder to shoulder with India against this common threat, from expanding intelligence sharing to cracking down on illicit terrorist financing, better securing our borders, ports, and public transportation, and helping to train thousands of Indian security personnel. The United States and India are committed to pursuing a comprehensive approach to countering violent extremism by empowering local communities, embracing diversity, and staying true to shared common values.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.